Dr. Daniel Barron is a chief resident in neuroscience at Yale Medical. He also recently wrote a fascinating article for Scientific American about the cost of medical education and where your tuition dollars are going. Let's hear his story and learn more about that article. Welcome to the 331st episode of the Mission Strike Talk, except it's a podcast dedicated to graduate missions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in." Not only in, but in at the best program for you. The featured resource for this podcast is the outstanding webinar, How to Nail Your Medical School Interviews, which was presented last month by Accepted Senior Med School Consultant, Sydney Foote. Learn how to prepare for your interview, what to do on interview day, and how to respond effectively to interview questions and much more by watching the webinar. You can access all this great information at accepted.com/331webinar. Again, that's accepted.com/331webinar. Our guest today is Dr. Daniel Barron. Dr. Barron grew up in Texas. He studied neuroscience and philosophy as an undergrad at UT, then pursued his MD-PhD there. His research focuses on brain disease, and he is currently the chief resident at Yale's Neuroscience Research Training Program and Clinical Neuroscience Research Unit. Dr. Barron, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining me. Now, can you tell me a little bit about your background outside of medicine, where you grew up, what you like to do for fun, et cetera?
Right. So I grew up in many different places around the U.S., primarily in Texas, as you mentioned. I also spent some time in Maryland and then also a little in Utah. That's where I went to high school. And so I spent a lot of time out in the countryside, running around, playing in my backyard in Georgetown. And then I really didn't consider much by way of science until my sophomore year at high school, when I had, I've heard a few podcasts where people talk about their AP biology teacher being a huge influence in their life. And that was exactly the case for me and Mr.
Really?
Frankum. Yeah. And that was really my first exposure to science. And it was just completely captivating. I studied really hard for it, harder than I thought I knew how to study, and ended up doing well in it. And after that, I kind of cemented my decision to pursue more science classes.
So you took the more science classes and just...
Yeah, I did the AP chemistry. I mean, this was a pretty small town in Utah, so there weren't a ton of them. I since heard about some private schools or larger public schools. You have 30 AP classes, but I think I took almost all of them at my high school, and that was 4, 5. I didn't take AP English or physics.
That's the one I took.
You did?
I took AP English.
Oh, well, that year we were supposed to read Don Quixote, and I had already read it, and I didn't want to read it again. So the summer between my junior and senior year, I audited a class at a local university. So kind of did a version of AP English, but kind of my own style.
Sounds good. What do you like to do for fun?
Well, now, so I probably read that I have a almost 2-year-old son. And so yesterday, actually, I guess one of my hobbies is fixing up old kind of broken things. And so I'd gotten my hands on a very old sailboat that needed some serious work. So I fixed it up. We went on a little sail yesterday. My little kids loved it.
Oh, that's great.
Loved the water and sailboats and stuff. So
that's
it
wonderful.
It takes a lot of time. Yeah.
Now, you seem to have been attracted to neuroscience fairly early, at least in your college career, and also have been fairly directed, at least since high school. How did you select neuroscience and psychiatry?
So one of the things that interested me about neuroscience was I remember actually my senior trip. Just after graduating from high school, I read a book, and I can't even remember what the name of it was, but it was talking about a lot of these neuroscience experiments wherein monkeys would be they would have their nerves severed, and then eventually they would be able to regain control of their arms, right? So essentially the theory at the time was once nerves die, then they don't regenerate. And so these experiments or these series of experiments was kind of overturning that, and I was just fascinated. So by some matter of will, these monkeys can convince, you know, their neurons to grow. And you know, my understanding was very simplistic back then, but I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting. I was also interested in why people like have motivations or desires or, you know, what gets people to think the way they do. And so actually the first class that I signed up for in undergrad was a neuroscience class. And that was Michael Brown. And it was the hardest class after AP Biology that I'd ever taken. And I remember going and talking.
It didn't turn you off though.
Oh, no. I thought it was interesting also. So, I mean, some things are difficult but boring. So this was difficult but really interesting. I remember talking to him after the first exam, and I think I got a pretty low C on it. And I'd graduated with a 4.0 in high school and had done that with relative ease at the, you know, the small town. And so getting a low C on my very first exam of undergrad wasn't very promising. And so he gave me, you know, what in retrospect must have been some really good therapy. And so I kind of went back at it. But it was fun. And then I started doing research in the neuroscience lab that first semester also with Scott Stephenson, and we had just a wonderful time.
And then the joining of neuroscience and psychiatry, obviously the two are closely related, but they're kind of going at it from very different angles, aren't they?
Right. They are. So actually the decision to enter psychiatry wasn't until probably a few months into my fourth year of medical school, the very final year of medical school. In undergrad, so I was interested in neuroscience and also in philosophy. And then in the first 2 years of medical school in San Antonio, I thought that epilepsy was fascinating. So this is something I'd read a lot about in undergrad also. You know, there's different seizure disorders and the types of altered perceptions they can cause, you know, temporal lobe epilepsy, you know, you have changes in consciousness. And so I ended up studying temporal lobe epilepsy using MRI. So I was looking for brain damage in epilepsy patients during grad school. And I thought, I was like, you know, maybe I'll go into neurosurgery. And I'd organized this traineeship in Bologna in Italy. And it was over the winter break. Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. And, you know, I got to, you know, observe what neurosurgeons do, see how epilepsy patients were worked up. So it was actually really just a wonderful thing. One of my advisors in San Antonio helped me set it up. And so I went from the very first evaluation in an outpatient neurology clinic all the way through the surgical intervention. You know, usually you treat patients with, you know, epilepsy that doesn't respond to medication by removing the part of the brain that causes the seizures. And I got to see all that. It was amazing. And but the lifestyle of the neurosurgeon and specifically the neurosurgery resident didn't seem like something I could endure very well. It's very rigorous and takes a lot of stamina and dedication. And I wasn't sure if that would, you know, kind of be the path for me. And so then I considered neurology and then psychiatry at the same time. What I enjoyed a lot about my psychiatry rotation was you had a lot of exposure to patients whose essentially their worldview, the way they interact with the world was changed as a result of an illness. And then if you were to intervene, you could, you know, you could treat specific symptoms, specific things that had gone awry in their, you know, cognition. And I thought that was much more engaging than what I was seeing in neurology as a medical student. Plus, I liked a lot of the attendings in psychiatry. So,
more than the neurosurgeons. Okay.
Yeah.
What was the hardest part of the med school and residency application process for you? And they might have been different things. They're two different processes that, you know, separated by many years, especially if you were doing a PhD.
So I remember, I don't remember a lot of the details, but I do remember one conversation in particular. I was sitting down with a guidance counselor in undergrad, and I was explaining how I had this real interest in research. You know, I was working in this neuroscience lab, but I also had this real desire to, you know, interact with patients. And so the research I've been doing was clinically oriented, you know, as much as you could have at, you know, as an undergraduate student. And I'd heard about MD-PhD programs, these dual degree programs. And I'd also heard that they were extremely competitive. And for whatever reason, I found that really deflating. And I was just like, oh, well, scratch that off my list. And then this guidance counselor, she was like, well, yes, it is competitive, but you need to go out there and be a competitor. And like, I just remember that entire conversation. And I thought about that a lot. So that was probably the biggest thing. After that, it became a little bit easier once I started to perceive myself as a competitor instead of, I don't know, whatever I was viewing myself as before then.
I recently attended a webinar given by the head of Stanford Graduate Business School's admissions. Actually, I think she's a director at the Graduate Business School's admissions. And the Stanford Business School has a 5-6% acceptance rate. It is the hardest business school to get into in the United States. And somebody asked about that, and she said, look, we have a self-selecting group of people who are willing, who find the benefits so appealing that they are willing to invest in themselves and take the chance in order to have that benefit. That's part of what defines the Stanford Business School student. They all know the acceptance rate, and they all say, I'm going to compete.
Yeah, which I think it's just a conscious thing that you have to do. I honestly don't know what I was thinking before that. I mean, there are probably a lot of things in my mind, like, I don't know, coming from a small town and all that, you know, mentality. But, you know, when push comes to shove, you know, if it's competitive, be a competitor. I guess that was really sound advice that I think about now.
Right. You don't have to reject yourself.
Yeah, right. Let them reject you, you know, or whatever. Writing the essays was interesting. I went through a lot of essay writing, and I had some friends who were better writers than me help me with that. The MCAT, actually, so this is something that might be encouraging to some of your listeners, that I am a terrible multiple choice test taker, like very, very bad. I get very anxious taking them because I always feel like there's more than one right answer, even though it's not true in theory. And so I ended up taking the MCAT 3 times. And I think the first time I took it, I got a 24, which was not good, as you
right,
know.
Right, right.
And then I think I got a 28, and then I got a 31 after that. And I probably would have taken it again, but I just ran out of time. So, each time, I think, you know, the anxiety of taking a test, you know, knowing how to answer the test is helpful. And also the first time I did it, I didn't even know that review courses existed. I just never really occurred to me, I guess. And then finally I found a copy of the Kaplan, the review books, you know, the ones that there's like 2 parts and each of them are like thick. I just went through that, and that seemed really helpful.
All right, good. Good to know. Now, did you do a gap year between college and med school, or?
I didn't, no. So I entered straight after undergrad. So I moved down to San Antonio, and I had like a month where I honestly didn't know what to do with myself. I remember being really stressed out about it. There was a German restaurant that has since gone out of business, like 4 blocks from my house. And I'd always been a waiter or, you know, a host. I worked at restaurants all in undergrad and high school. So I actually applied for a job.
just have something to do.
Yeah, this restaurant that was nearby. I wasn't quite sure what to do. And I ended up not even getting a call back. You know, they probably could tell I wasn't going to be there very long. But that was a lot of fun. And then I started. So usually MD-PhD programs, what they want you to do is get into a lab or get to sample different labs. And so I got really lucky. And one of my interviewers, when I was on the interview trail for the MD-PhD programs, was at the Brain Imaging Institute. And so I had kind of peripherally heard of this method called magnetic resonance imaging, but I didn't really know much about it. And this guy was at the Brain Imaging Center in San Antonio, which is just huge. It's a very big brain imaging center. They have multiple scanners. They have a cyclotron, a PET scanner, which can use these radio tracers, like lots of really cool equipment. And so I kind of fell into that during interviews. And so I organized my first lab rotation there. And I ended up staying not with the advisor that I had the first rotation with, but at kind of towards the end of that rotation, I touched base with Peter Fox, who's the director of the Institute. And we started working on a project that same summer. And we hit it off, and he ended up being my dissertation advisor.
Oh, wonderful.
So, yeah, and a lot of how your grad school experience goes depends on your advisor.
Absolutely.
And so sure. I really lucked out. And, you know, Peter remains a very good friend to this day. And, you know, we had a great time working together. So it turned out to be really well.
Great. So you started at UT in San Antonio, and then because you got married, you ended up transferring to Yale for your clinical, right? So you did the first part of medical school, your research at UT. What did you like best about your experience at UT?
It was very practical. Okay. I really liked that part. And I mean, I don't think there's any question, at least among my friends that I keep in touch with from San Antonio. The anatomy class was incredible. And we had human dissection, which maybe some schools now only do digital dissection. You know, you could
find, they use not mannequins, but some kind of
models.
Right.
Yeah, that in combination with, you know, these three-dimensional digital tools. But I thought it was a lot of fun getting hands-on experience dissecting and really like feeling where the nerves were running. That was wonderful. They also were very pragmatic. I felt like the pragmatism centered around passing boards, which is what every medical student really wants to do. Right? Like you want to be able to take your step one, which is the first of the three step exams. You want to be able to take it and do well. That way you get into a good residency program. And they were very helpful in teaching about that. Also, another thing that I really liked about my program, so as an MD-PhD student, we had our own faculty advisor, who is still the director of the MD-PhD program, Jose Cavazos. He was really wonderful. He turned out he was an epileptologist, and so ended up being on my dissertation committee also, and very supportive. We really got along well, so that was excellent. I couldn't emphasize more that going into a program where you have the support and confidence of whoever's going to be your director is a really good idea, especially if you want to do research.
What did you like best about your experience, both in terms of the clinical rotations and then as a resident at Yale?
So the rotations were wonderful. I got to choose, kind of tailor what it was I wanted to do third year, which was nice. I mean, even the rotations that I knew I didn't want to do, like OB-GYN, I knew I wasn't going to be an obstetrician. They required just for you to graduate. And I remember that was, it's in the winter and I had to drive like 25 minutes. I knew I didn't want to do it. So that was rough. But otherwise, I got to do pretty much what I wanted. In fact, fourth year, because I wanted to go into psychiatry, and at the time you weren't required to do a sub-internship or sub-I, as it's called, I was able to organize a six-month postdoc over at Oxford. And that was really cool. Yeah. And so I was over there. I had a small amount of funding through the medical school, but I ended up taking out a student loan to help with that. And it was well worth it, I think. It was a wonderful opportunity, and I still keep in touch with them. It's good, which I'm not sure I would have been able to do that at another institution. So
Right. Now, speaking of funding, that gets us to the article that you wrote for Scientific American. In addition to being a chief resident at Yale, you also write regularly, actually, for Scientific American, and recently wrote an article about the punishing student debt that you and your wife are dealing with. Does the fact that you are writing for Scientific American stem from the fact that you're trying to pay down that debt?
No. So I actually started writing when I was in med school. And
okay.
Before the debt thing had hit me. And so in terms of being, you know, paid, I mean, I'll just be upfront. I get paid $300 for each of those essays, and that's like nothing.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not nothing, but, you know, it's more of like a matter of principle sort of thing. They should pay me something. But
it's not worth the time that you clearly invested in it. Yeah.
So I write for fun. And also, I've really enjoyed working with my editor there. Like, one of my goals doing that is both to try to resolve some things I don't quite understand either in clinic or the world generally. I have a lot of leeway. I can write about pretty much whatever I want, and, you know, he'll help me kind of edit things. So it's been really, really nice.
All right. Now, we're going to link to your article on medical student debt from the show notes at exceba.com/331. But can you briefly summarize the main point of the article?
Yeah, so the main point was kind of a personal investigation of where specifically my wife's tuition money went. And so I am in a unique position of, as an MD PhD student, never paying tuition for that part. And then, however, she paid a lot in tuition. And so after we met with our accountant and realized exactly how much in student loans we had, you know, these same sort of budget tools that, you know, we're taught on our exit interviews for medical school, you know, like, where's all of your money going? Like, how is it being spent? You know, where does every dollar go? So that's what they tell us to do. So then we started using those tools, and I got to wondering how the medical tuition was spent. And so I was really happy to interview Robert Grossman at NYU, who had recently made the announcement that tuition would no longer be charged of the NYU medical student. I was like, oh, well, here's a fellow who might know where tuition dollars are going. And he went through it with me, and specific to his institution, perhaps, the tuition wasn't going solely to fund student education, but was being used for many non-educational related things. And then, you know, I was kind of curious if that was the case at other schools. So I spoke to a couple of regulators, one at the LCME and the other at the AIMC. And those conversations, you know, the people at the LCME care very much about student debt, and they try to minimize student debt. However, they really don't have any information about how the tuition is spent at specific schools. And so what they do is they focus on education quality as a surrogate measure, which, you know, in their position seems reasonable. However, that didn't really answer my question. And so I went and spoke with an economist at Harvard, and I had a really lot of fun speaking with him. He's kind of a firebrand of a person. And he very clearly agreed with Grossman, saying that, you know, medical student tuition probably does not go to support student education, which would cost around what he thought, what Grossman said it would cost. And we had this really fun exchange about kind of the economics of tuition, and how schools will charge as much as they can price-wise without suffering in terms of their applicant pool. And so that's just the market economy. And so even though it's regulated, the regulators don't really have the power, the insight to regulate in a way that they can have insight into where tuition is going. So,
did either the Harvard professor or Dean Grossman indicate how much it really should cost to educate a medical student, either in total or per year or whatever?
No. Yeah, I never got that number, like what it ought to cost. And, you know, this is a conversation I had with Chandra at The Economist. He, I mean, it seems reasonable that it would cost different numbers at every institution. And I mean, different institutions, different medical schools have different.
Actually, I would assume that NYU's tuition would be through the roof simply because of the value of the land that it's on.
True. So they own their buildings also. So, I mean,
right.
You know, whatever
tax dollars
they're paying, you know, they would have to pay that, and then maintenance, electricity.
The cost of living is high.
Yeah. And so that's a point that I really liked what Grossman was saying. So he felt comfortable not charging tuition, because that was a standardized way that across the board he could benefit students. He didn't feel comfortable subsidizing living expenses because, you know, in New York, perhaps more than any other city in the U.S., you can live on a, you know, $2,000 a month budget or a $2 million a month budget. So just depending on what your lifestyle is. You know, maybe
10,000 might be tough in New York City.
Well, I know some. Yeah, I know some people who kind of scrape by on like ramen and stuff. But there's a lot more variability, and it'd be much harder to standardize in terms of living expenses than just in tuition. And so, you know, one of the hopes also in investigating that piece and writing about it was, you know, people talk a lot about the student debt crisis and how there's, you know, unsustainable, skyrocketing debt, you know, blah, blah, you know, pick a topic related to student debt. And yet no one's really asking where the money goes, you know, and, you know, sure, living expenses, like I mentioned that trip I went to Oxford, like, yeah, I didn't need to do that, but I chose to do that. So that one's kind of on me. But in terms of tuition and the skyrocketing tuition that, you know, not just in medical school, but all graduate schools, undergraduate schools, like, where is that money going? And is that money that's actually being spent educating the student, which is what at face value they're taking those loans out for? Like, no student would ask a lender to fund a new library development for, you know, I don't know, Harvard or Yale or somewhere, but they ask for money to pay for their student tuition. And so is that money being used actually to educate them? I'm convinced that at least in medical education, there's no clear answer, but I think there could be more clarity if there's more transparency in the process.
Well, again, is there a way to put a dollar amount on what it costs to educate a medical school student? I mean, by the way, Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles also is right. Not charging tuition for the first 5 years.
Right. And if I recall right, that press release was them, they weren't cutting it off in 5 years. They were going to reevaluate in 5 years. And so they very well might continue.
I believe that's true. But their intention is their class is very small. They're starting class with, I think, 48 or 49 students. And they're going to have tons of applications for those spots with that price tag.
Sure.
Market forces at work. You know, what would you like medical school to have cost? What do you think medical students should pay?
So I think people should be given enough information to make an educated decision. Mm-hmm. So say medical school tuition, like in the case of NYU, costs $55,000.
Total. Right?
Like, total. Well, plus fees. It was a little bit more fees before Grossman made the announcement. But where is that money going? Like, if they were to break it down and say, you know, 40,000 of the 55,000 goes to support a new library that we're building to improve student education. You know, a student could decide. He's like, okay, do I want to bankroll $120,000 or I guess it'd be $160,000 of this new library? And then they can decide whether to apply there or not. Great. Actually, there's another interesting perspective. Do you ever listen to Malcolm Gladwell's revisionist?
I've read a couple of his books. I don't listen to his podcast. I've read a couple of his books. I've read Blink and Outliers.
Yeah, he has this podcast, kind of the similar style. Like, I really like the way he thinks about things. Mm-hmm. And he discusses law schools and how LSAT inflation, like taking the LSAT doesn't necessarily set you up for being a good lawyer, because the skill set is very different from what's required for a lawyer. And obviously, I'm just parroting what he said since I know nothing about LSAT or law school.
Well, you could make the same argument about the MCAT.
Oh, I could definitely make that argument. Does not prepare you to be a good doctor. But his point was the reason that LSAT is important is that the top 14, I think it was, the top law schools, you know, rank applicants based on that. And if you want to go to a top law school, I guess the logic would be if you want to get a good job after law school, you have to go to a top law school. And in order to get into a good law school, you have to do well on the LSAT. And so there's another kind of form of not quite data-driven inflation of something not directly related to education.
Well, I think that could be said about all the aptitude tests. He's picking on law school.
Sure.
But,
sure.
You know, that's the argument against, you know, that's the argument for test optional, SAT optional admissions in college. you know, business schools take the GMAT or the GRE, and they now start taking something called the executive assessment. LSAT is now, the law schools are now taking the GRE in addition to the LSAT. MCAT is the MCAT. There's no alternative to medical school. I think some PA programs allow the MCAT or the GRE. But, you know, I once asked somebody in medical education, you know, is there a correlation to the MCAT and being a good doctor? And he said, well, that's an interesting question, because how do you define what makes a good doctor?
Right.
How do you measure that? How do you quantify that in order to have some kind of empirical study and correlation?
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of it's pragmatic also. I mean, I've been on admission committees in San Antonio, and, you know, it's hard going through, like you mentioned, the 6% acceptance rate at, you know, business school.
Medical schools have lower ones.
Right. Well, I mean, how do you divide, like, how do you use your time best as an admissions committee? So you have to have some line to draw, and that seems like as arbitrary a line as any other. But unfortunately, it's created an industry, not simply just a test, but an entire industry that doesn't really have much to do with the doctoring.
Right. I guess, the point of the MCAT in particular is to see if you can handle the academic aspect of medical school.
Yeah, I do remember it was either my first or second year of medical school. We had brought this up. And I just feel like during one of those meetings, someone mentioned that MCAT scores were correlated with graduation from medical school.
And I think
correlated
step one
with board exams.
And I think that,
and that was the thing. Yeah, board scores and graduating, which, you know, step one doesn't have a whole lot to do with being a good doctor either. That's just a review of all of your, you know, clinical science. Which, you know, I've forgotten almost all of my biochemistry by now. Maybe that's not good for me to say for this year.
Yeah, and I mean, I can imagine that's what happens. How do you see your career evolving after residency? You must be almost finished with it.
Yeah, so I'm in the fourth year of 4 years right now. And so I'll graduate in June. And I'm looking to do a fellowship in pain medicine, because there's a lot of exciting pain medicine research. And I like the interventional aspect also. It's fun. I mentioned how I like fixing up things, kind of hands-on activities, and I've really enjoyed, you know, rotating through pain medicine clinics. I very much want to continue brain imaging research. So the type of research that I've been interested in is, you know, biomarker development. So being able to find some, they call it signatures of a disease or an illness or symptom category that is based in biology, like a blood pressure measurement for the heart, you know, find a blood pressure measurement for the brain. And there's a lot of funding right now to do that in pain. And I'm excited about that.
Okay. So it's interesting. So you started out kind of with this idea of nerve growth in monkeys way back when, and then you moved into epilepsy, which I guess is also some kind of nerve malfunction, if you will, or communication between when the brain malfunction. I'm a lay person. I don't know the science.
No, you're right.
And now again, it's trying to interfere with a nerve that's misfiring, if you will. Right. Again, talking from a strictly lay perspective.
No, you're absolutely right. So the question that I'm really interested in is, how is what we observe behaviorally, how is that manifest in the tissue, like in the organ, the brain? And so in epilepsy, I was looking for where the brain is damaged and how does that damage relate to seizures. I have a study, you know, I'm doing different analyses. They call it a trends diagnostic analysis. You're looking at different psychiatric illnesses, trying to see how those diseases are manifest in the brain. And at the same time, in the future, I hope to understand how pain and those psychiatric illnesses are manifest in the brain. So there's a high co-occurrence rate. I mean, you can imagine how having a chronic pain condition would be depressing. And so, you know, so there's a high incidence of both.
It's also, I mean, there is a question whether certain forms of chronic pain are really physiological or psychologically based, right? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. So it's interesting because pain medicine originally was almost entirely in the domain of anesthesiology. However, as you know, pain management teams have become what they call more interdisciplinary, meaning now people appreciate the cognitive or psychiatric aspects. So psychiatrists can now be pain medicine doctors. And you also have physical medicine rehabilitation doctors in on the team, because a lot of it's rehabilitative problems. And you have a neurologist in now. And I think primary care residents or clinicians can also apply for the fellowship. Don't quote me on that. I can't remember.
I won't.
But thanks.
What would you like me to ask you?
So this is for people who are thinking about applying to medical school or to residency.
Correct. Exactly.
I guess my advice would be to work hard, but don't take yourself too seriously. For me, applying for residency was a lot of fun. So I also applied for research tracks. So many different residency programs have like these sub programs specific to research. And so I had a very focused interview season. So some people apply for like 40 programs, and I only applied for 5 because I knew where I would want to do research. So that might be helpful. Just be very targeted.
Okay. I guess be thoughtful and intentional about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Barron, I think we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your insight and putting up with the glitchy technology. Where can listeners find you online to learn more about you or to read your articles?
You can definitely find me on my webpage on Scientific American or on Twitter. I guess you can link out to my Twitter handle.
Okay, we'll do.
Thank you for having me on. This has been a real pleasure. Even with the technological troubles, which, you know, who can predict those? Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. We'll link to Dr. Barron's Scientific American articles, as well as his Twitter handle and other resources related to this podcast from exhibit.com/331. Listener, thank you too for joining Dr. Daniel Barron and me for Admission Straight Talk's 331st episode. Final reminder and a favor, if you missed the live webinar, How to Nail Your Medical School Interviews, don't miss the recording. Learn how to prepare for your med school interviews, answer questions effectively, and simply nail it. Access the recording at exhibit.com/331webinar. Again, that's exhibit.com/331webinar. And the favor, if you find the show worthwhile, please tell a friend about Admission Straight Talk. They'll thank you, and so do I. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.